Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I want to thank you all as well, because for the first time in the 200 years of the Republic, I will become the first woman president of Mexico.
Mexico makes history by electing its first woman president, Claudia Sheinbaum, a climate scientist who served as the mayor of Mexico City. We'll go to Mexico for the latest. But we start in India, where the world's largest election ever has just ended. In a surprising setback, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party may lose a significant number of seats in parliament. Then to El Salvador, to the weekend inauguration of Nayib Bukele, who's described himself as the world's coolest dictator. Those who attended the ceremony included U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, as well as Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump Jr. Plus, we speak to the head of Save the Children about Israel's war on Gaza that's killed over 15,000 children.
More children have been killed in this conflict than have been killed in all armed conflicts globally every year over the past 4 years.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. is urging the U.N. Security Council to adopt a resolution in support of the Gaza ceasefire and hostage deal outlined by President Biden. Israel and Hamas have not yet agreed to the deal. Israel continues to pummel the Gaza Strip, where the official death toll has exceeded 36,500, with over 82,000 people injured. Israel's killed at least 15,000 Palestinian children since October 7th. In Khan Yunis, relatives searched on Monday for loved ones after another Israeli airstrike.
I am shocked. I am looking for my mother. My wish is to see my mother. I want to find her in front of me. God is my suffice and my best disposer of my affairs. Children who are innocent were asleep. They threw an explosive barrel on them. They tore them apart. What have they done to deserve this? This feeling is indescribable. It is like we're in a nightmare. It is as though we are in a dream. A dream. I pray to God that I wake up and find out that it was only a dream and that it is not true.
In other news from Khan Yunis, displaced Gazans were flooded with sewage Monday as a pipeline burst in the overcrowded city, pouring waste into tents. The Israeli military said Monday four more Israeli hostages have died. Hamas had previously said three of the men, who were all in their 80s, were killed in Israeli airstrikes. Meanwhile, the UN has condemned the unprecedented bloodshed in the occupied West Bank, where over 500 Palestinians have been killed since October 7th. Over the weekend, two teenagers were killed by Israeli forces. In other news from the region, Iranian media said Monday's Israeli airstrikes in Aleppo, Syria, killed a Revolutionary Guard general. Yemen's Houthi movement says its fighters targeted a military site in Israel's port city of Eilat as it vows to keep intensifying its attacks. Israeli military says it intercepted the ballistic missile. The Maldives says it's banning Israeli tourists over their government's, quote, genocidal acts, unquote, in Gaza. Meanwhile, a group of UN experts said Monday all nations, quote, must follow the example of 146 United Nations member states and recognize the state of Palestine, unquote. At the University of Toronto, students and faculty held a vigil Monday for the students in Gaza who've been deprived of a graduation due to the war. Graduation caps adorned empty chairs in tribute to Palestinian students who've been killed or have had their lives upended. University of Toronto students said they'll continue their encampment protest until their school divests from Israel.
U of T's investments serve the interests of the Israeli state. That is not neutrality. Palestinian students and their tuition money is going into these weapons manufacturing companies that are committing the murder of their family members and their friends. This is despicable, and we must stand up against it.
In San Francisco, police arrested 70 protesters who occupied the first floor of the Israeli consulate and refused to leave Monday. This is one of the activists.
Red line. The people are going to have to end this. People power has always been the change. Our government is not listening, and they are enabling this genocide. And so we have to be the disruptors and make it stop.
Here in New York, as Pride Month gets underway, hundreds of queer activists took to the streets and staged a die-in, calling for a ceasefire and an end to U.S. funding for Israel. Activists are demanding mainstream LGBTQ plus groups like Outright International speak out against the war. In Bonn, Germany, protesters interrupted a UN climate conference ahead of November's COP29, holding up a banner that read, "No business as usual during a genocide." As votes are still being tallied in India's election, early results show Prime Minister Narendra Modi is poised to win a third term. But his Hindu nationalist BJP appears to have lost significant support since the last elections in 2019. And the opposition Indian National Congress looks likely to double its parliamentary elections. We'll go to Delhi for the latest after headlines. In Sudan, the UN is again warning of the spiraling humanitarian disaster.
Time is running out for millions of people, including 3.6 million acutely malnourished children who are at risk of famine, and they are displaced from their lands, living under bombardments and cut off from humanitarian aid.
Fighting between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces remains particularly intense in Khartoum and the Darfur city of El Fasher. At least 15,550 people have been killed, nearly 9 million displaced since the conflict broke out last year. In Nigeria, union leaders have launched another strike demanding salary increases for workers amidst the skyrocketing cost of living. The strike forced major airports and Nigeria's electricity grid to shut down Monday. Workers across Abuja and Lagos walked off the job while others blocked the entrances to the offices. This is a leader with Nigeria's air transport union, Emmanuel Jaja.
Now we are inflicting hardship on Nigerians, which is not the normal thing. So if it is government that is thinking about their citizens, I think they should rethink and we'll go back to the table.
President Biden is expected to sign an executive order that would temporarily shut down the U.S.-Mexico border and suspend protections for migrants seeking asylum. Under the new measure, U.S. officials would cap asylum requests at the southern border at no more than 2,500 per day. The border would be closed if asylum claims surpass that figure. The executive order is likely to face legal challenges and has been described as the most restrictive border policy issued by any recent Democratic president. Mexico's cooperation is key in enforcing the order, as migrants barred from the U.S. would be forced to wait across the border in Mexico. ProPublica has revealed Donald Trump's businesses and campaign committees have given significant financial benefits to at least 9 witnesses in the various criminal cases against the former president and what legal experts say could amount to witness tampering. ProPublica reports one campaign aide had his salary doubled. Another received a $2 million severance package, barring him from voluntarily cooperating with law enforcement. This comes as Donald Trump has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to annul his guilty verdict in New York. The Texas Supreme Court Friday rejected a challenge by 20 patients and 2 abortion providers who sued Texas after the state's abortion ban prevented them from receiving or administering urgent health care. The lawsuit sought to clarify and expand the medical exceptions that are supposedly permitted under the abortion ban. The Center for Reproductive Rights, which brought the case, said, quote, as women across the country are finding out, exceptions to abortion bans are illusory, and it's dangerous to be pregnant in any state state that bans abortion, they said. Here in New York City, community organizers are condemning plans to build a new police training facility in Queens that'll cost some $225 million. New York City Mayor Eric Adams made the announcement on Friday. Construction for the training center is expected to begin in 2026, with plans for it to be operational in 2030. Critics have compared the so-called Public Safety Academy to Atlanta's widely contested Cop City, a massive $90 million police training complex being built in the Uilani Forest. And in Hong Kong, some activists are marking the 35th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, despite a ban on protests and a heightened crackdown by authorities. On Monday, police arrested artist Sanmu Chen as he engaged in a protest performance. In the middle of a busy street, Chen appeared to mimic pouring himself a drink and toasting, followed by drawing the numbers 8964 in the air with his fingers, the date of the massacre. One June 4th, 1989, the Chinese military attacked a student-led pro-democracy protest in Beijing, killing hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in India, where preliminary results from the world's largest election suggest Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party will have a reduced majority in parliament. Meanwhile, the opposition alliance, known by the acronym IND, Rahul Gandhi's centrist Congress party, is doing better than expected. India's seven-phase election began April 19th, ended Saturday. If Modi wins, he would be just the second Indian leader to serve a third term after India's first prime minister, Nehru. Many voters faced searingly hot temperatures as they went to the polls. Some record-breaking temperatures. Others, like vocal Modi critic Arvind Kejriwal, surrendered to prison after voting. He's a former senior tax official who founded an anti-corruption party and was arrested on corruption charges, which he denies.
I want to say to the people of Delhi that I'm going to jail again, not because I have done a scam, but because I have raised my voice against dictatorship.
Meanwhile, in North Kashmir, a candidate known as Engineer Rashid, who's jailed on militancy charges, has won his race against a candidate who has already conceded. Opponents of Prime Minister Narendra Modi have accused him of using hate speech after he described Muslims in India as infiltrators. This is Modi addressing an election rally in April.
Do you think you're a traitor? Would you accept this? This is what the Congress's manifesto is saying.
This comes as journalists who are critical of Prime Minister Modi have been expelled, investigated, and raided by his government. For more, we go to New Delhi, India. We're joined by Ran Ayoub, Indian journalist and global opinions writer for The Washington Post, where her latest article is headlined, Journalism in India is Under Assault. She's the author of Gujarat Files, Anatomy of a Cover-Up. We thank you so much for joining us, Rana. If you can start off by talking about the significance of the election results. What is so surprising today?
Hello, Amy. Good to be back on the show. You know, everybody in this country and exit polls in this country were predicting a massive third term for Prime Minister Modi. What is significant is that this entire election one was fought around the cult of Modi, which it is fought around the vilification of Muslims. In every electoral speech, every rally that Modi took, he was vilifying Muslims. He was calling them infiltrators, outsiders, so on and so forth. More than anything else, it was probably also one of the most undemocratic elections, with opposition leaders being jailed before the elections, income tax and enforcement directorate raids on the Indian opposition, their bank accounts frozen. In that context, when the numbers of the ruling party is reduced to this number, to what we are seeing today, it's quite a massive reduction. It really impacts the cult and the popularity of Modi, because the entire election campaign was fought around Modi's guarantee, Modi's promise. Across billboards in India, you had Modi literally blessing Indians, right? That's what he was doing. So I think this election result, specifically 3 months after the Ram Temple inauguration, which was built on a demolished mosque in Ayodhya. Now, the significant part of this is that 80% of the constituency, Faizabad, where the Ram Temple stands, is Hindus. And today the BJP lost in that constituency, which means you cannot drum up the anti-Muslim, Hindu majoritarian sentiment to the extent, because people in India wanted jobs. People in India, there's rural distress. And I think that has really spoken up this time around. The people of India have spoken up against what they have been facing. I think the anti-Muslim rhetoric has not quite worked for Modi this time around in the third term. And if that had happened, then it would have been really dangerous for India.
And Ron, I wanted to ask you, India has long had a vibrant leftist and communist movement. How did those left parties, how have they been doing in this election from what you can tell?
At this point of time, we have something called India Alliance, which also includes, you know, left parties and the left in Kerala and other bastions. I think this time around, the India Alliance, which includes the Indian National Congress and other regional parties, which stitch together an alliance based on caste, class, language, religion. I think that played a fundamental role. And I think a big credit needs to be given to the regional parties of India, especially in Uttar Pradesh. Now, the BJP derives its biggest support system from Uttar Pradesh in North India, where we have also seen all sorts of hate crimes, bulldozing of Muslim households. In a state like that, in a province like that, the BJP has been reduced to half. So I think local actors and regional parties who have worked really hard in this election, trying to move the conversation from the anti-Muslim rhetoric, the fundamentalism, back to unemployment, back to rural distress, I think that has played a significant role in this election. And the hubris of Modi, I mean, this entire campaign. Okay, just before the election result, Modi was meditating in Kanyakumari, imitating Swami Vivekananda, and, you know, all the cameras surrounding him, a godlike figure. He also said in an interview that he believes that he was not biological born, but divine born. So this election result, it might still give Modi a third term, but it has punctured the hubris around Modi, where he has gone around telling that he's the most popular leader in the world. He stopped the war in the world. He stopped the Ukraine war. So that hubris has been punctured. And I think the regional parties have a big role to play, along with the Indian National Congress.
And also, you mentioned the anti-Muslim campaigning. What the Citizenship Amendment Act, the new citizenship law that recently passed in India that Modi has vowed now to implement. Could you talk about that and this whole effectively creating religious criteria for citizenship?
Well, Muslims in India have been living in fear. With the results, there has been a great deal of cynicism, because the Citizenship Amendment Act and the National Register of Citizens, it allows, I mean, Muslims will have to prove their citizenship. And persecuted minorities, except Muslims, will be given citizenship in India. And it was notified just 2 months before the elections. This, along with what the government is trying to introduce, the Uniform Civil Code, so that the Muslim code will be taken away, and many such majoritarian politics. But what is interesting with this election result is that I was sitting this morning with Muslims who have been arrested in the past. I was watching the election results with them. And these are people who have been quite cynical. When I asked them, what did this mean to them? And they said that this might not immediately stop the persecution of Muslims, but it might give them the breathing space. It might give them the space to resist at a time when some of India's best known student activists and Muslim activists are behind bars. So I think it's a bit of a shot in the arm. It might be too early yet, not knowing how one can predict Modi's majoritarian politics. But it has certainly given a shot in the arm to the ones who wanted to resist and to hope for a better India, for a democratic India. Because the biggest fear for all of us was it was the democracy of the country which was at stake, the democratic norms which were at stake in this election, you know, with the world's largest democracy. Voter suppression, Muslim voters were not allowed to vote in many areas, in many constituencies in India. So with all this kept in mind, I feel that a reduced majority for Modi could be a sigh of relief for Muslims in the country.
Comedian John Oliver addressed Prime Minister Modi in a new episode of his show This Week Tonight, which he said he doubted would be allowed to air in India. And in fact, it has not. And it's not available on YouTube there either. This is a clip.
You would think that all of this would be fertile ground for Modi's critics to exploit. But it's actually hard to do that in India. For one thing, it's difficult to confront him to his face because he hasn't held a single press conference in India in the last 10 years. And the interviews that he's granted have been the exact opposite of hard-hitting.
Do you carry a purse on you? A wallet to hold your cash?
Do you have a best friend? Best friend forever? With whom you share matters of the heart?
At this age, how do you bring so much energy?
Does our prime minister eat mangoes? Does he cut it first or eat it with the stone still in?
Okay, most of those questions are embarrassing softballs, but how do you eat a mango is a valid thing to ask.
That was John Oliver with Last Week Tonight. Also, the highly acclaimed, award-winning Indian writer Arundhati Roy has said if the BJP wins this election, India will not remain a democracy. This is Arundhati Roy when she accepted the 2023 European Essay Award in September.
It is no longer just our leaders we must fear, but a whole section of the population. The banality of evil, as Hannah Arendt would have called it, the normalization of evil is now manifest in our streets, in our classrooms, in our very many public spaces. The mainstream press, the hundreds of 24-hour news channels have been harnessed to the cause of fascist majoritarianism. India's constitution has effectively been set aside. The Indian Penal Code is being rewritten. If the current regime wins a majority in 2024, it is very likely we will see a new constitution.
That's the great writer, Arundhati Roy. Rana Ayub, if you can respond, and also for a global audience, you are the author of Gujarat Files, who don't understand who Narendra Modi is, going back to the Gujarat massacre when he was in charge of Gujarat, and then denied entry into the United States for years for responsibility for that massacre. If you can explain who he is, the past and, well, future prime minister of India.
Well, Amy, he is, I'll take you back to a debate on a channel called NDTV when the 9/11 terror attack took place and Narendra Modi was on that debate. He was back then just a BJP leader. And when he was asked to comment on the issue, he said, well, the root cause of it was Islam. And he cherry-picked quotes of Islam, from the Quran. Back in 2002, when he was the chief minister of Gujarat, I have written a book on the Gujarat carnage of Muslims and the extrajudicial murder of Muslims, where fake encounters were done of Muslims where they were alleged to be terrorists and they were shot dead to create this image of Modi, the Hindu leader, under attack from Islamists. His entire career has centered around the Muslim as the other, as the enemy. When he was the chief minister of Gujarat, 1,000 Muslims were massacred under his watch. And soon after, he became the chief minister of Gujarat. And around the same time, he had referred to the Muslims and the relief camps of where Muslims were being kept, the ones who were affected by the Gujarat carnage, as child-producing factories. His entire career has centered around vilification of Muslims. And then, of course, the series of fake encounters in which his deputy Amit Shah, the second most important man in the country, the Home Minister of India, was arrested in 2010 for the extrajudicial murder of a man called Sohrabuddin and Tulsi Prajapati and Sohrabuddin's wife, Kausarbi. He was later, of course, acquitted in the case. And so this is the history. And he was stopped by the United States from entering the country for his role in human rights excesses. This is the history of Narendra Modi. He played a big part in canvassing for a Ram temple when the Babri Masjid was demolished as a Hindu nationalist. He derives his inspiration from the RSS. It's a paramilitary Hindu nationalist organization, and he claims allegiance to that. over a period of years, I mean, I have seen his journey when I went to Gujarat as a relief worker during the Gujarat riots to a journalist who was reporting the Gujarat elections and then the prime ministerial election. One thing that has remained consistent about Modi and his politics is Hindu majoritarianism, Hindu nationalism, and the vilification of Muslims. I mean, I think one of the most significant part of this election was that even during the Gujarat riots, he would refer to Muslims, he would allude to, or he would do dog whistles. There would be dog whistles against Muslims, but never a direct reference to Muslims. In this particular election, the speeches that he has given, he has called Muslims directly as infiltrators. He has said, if the opposition comes to power, you will have more Muslims in the cricket team. If the opposition comes to power, there will be more Muslims here. There is an entire ad created by, an advertisement created by the BJP, in which the Muslim is caricatured as somebody who has destroyed Indian civilization. So that is the history of Modi, political history of Modi, which is his career has survived on the vilification of Muslims throughout. And it is very important for this election result, although we do know that Modi is going to get a third term, but it was very important that a reduced majority, a mandate was given so that this hatred, in a way, could be stopped, could be halted for a bit. We don't know what Modi is up to. We don't know what he can do to win elections. But this Hindu nationalistic agenda, this idea of a Hindu India that he has been selling to the average Indian, I think that did not work really well for him this time.
Rana Ayub, I want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow this. Indian journalist, global opinions writer for The Washington Post, author of Gujarat Files, Anatomy of a Cover-Up, speaking to us from New Delhi, India. Next up, we look at the Mexican election, where the first woman's been elected president. But first to El Salvador, to the weekend inauguration of Nayib Bukele, who's described himself as the world's coolest dictator. Among those there from the United States for the ceremony, Alejandro Mayorkas, Tucker Carlson, and Donald Trump Jr. Back in 20 seconds. Shankar, Song from the Hills. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to El Salvador, where President Nayib Bukele has been sworn in for a second term. The move has been widely denounced as illegitimate and a violation of El Salvador's constitution, which limits presidents to just 1 5-year term and prohibits consecutive elections. In 2021, El Salvador's Constitutional Court ruled in favor of Bukele's re-election bid after his allies in the Salvadoran National Assembly illegally removed all 5 magistrates from the court, replacing them with Bukele supporters. The self-proclaimed world's coolest dictator spoke Saturday from the capital, San Salvador.
Hace 5 años, aquí en esta misma plaza,
5 years ago, in this same plaza, I asked you to trust in us and the decisions we are going to take, even if some of them seem like bitter medicine. The people of El Salvador took the decision to follow the prescription, and together we have rid ourselves of gang cancer.
President Bukele's inauguration comes as his government continues to enforce a state of exception in El Salvador, a so-called war on gangs that's led to the detention of nearly 80,000 people since 2022, many without charge or access to due process. Human rights groups have warned of gross violations and torturous conditions inside overcrowded Salvadoran prisons, and estimate at least 240 people have died in police custody. Despite growing concerns for Bukele's authoritarianism, the Biden administration sent a high-level delegation led by Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the inauguration. Just 3 years ago, Biden officials had refused to meet with Bukele in D.C. amidst concerns of his anti-democratic rule. Also in attendance at Saturday's inauguration in San Salvador was Argentina's right-wing president Javier Milei. Donald Trump